are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, August 8th, 2018. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Harvard professor of sociology Bruce Western on Homeward, life in a year after prison. Meanwhile, primary day all across the country, Missouri voters reversed the state's move to kneecap unions. And in Ohio's 12th, still slightly undecided. But the bottom line is Dems with a near 13-point swing. Good win in Ferguson, but left largely shut out in those primaries. Chris Kobach may have eked it out. And good news, Rashida Tlaib, a Muslim woman, takes Conyers seats, could be the first and probably will be the first elected to Congress ever. And while down in Florida, Mar-a-Lago members are now unofficially running the VA.
What? Sounds great.
And welcome back, asbestos. EPA blesses the material that still kills 40,000 people a year.
Can I bring that back?
Great again.
And Republican Congressman Chris Collins, New York's 27th, arrested and charged with insider trading. And lastly, so there's a guy who has, what, $30 million in the bank and is insider trading his position as a congressman. Meanwhile, Chicago police are driving around in a van with sneakers and parking it with the doors open in areas of poverty in Chicago and using it as a bait truck to arrest children. All that and more on today's program. That's a heartwarming tale, isn't it? We will get to that later in the program. Big primary night. And largely, the preferred candidates of Sanders and Ocasio-Cortez did not win. Some of them were more long shots than others. Big night for women broadly in general across the board. But we will run down those in a minute. But let's go to Kansas, where Chris Kobach, it appears, but it's really like hundreds of votes still, appears that he won his primary for governorship. Now, here's the thing. Supposedly, some folks want him to win because he would be the weakest candidate, and that may be the case, but it's still Kansas. There is a third-party challenger. I'm not sure what party he's running from has been nominated by. But a guy named Greg Orman, he may take as many Democratic votes as he will Republican. And from what I've heard, that Orman needs to take significantly more Republican votes for the Democrat to win. Chris Kobach is, I don't know if he's a fascist, but he's pretty darn close. We spoke about yesterday, the revelations that both that he used his basically went around the country and convinced counties or municipalities to pass draconian immigration laws that were then challenged because of their constitutionality. He defended these cities in all these losing cases, made nearly $1 million over the course of a decade or so, and cost taxpayers millions of dollars. Then he went on to form a voter integrity national commission, which was just revealed days ago because of a lawsuit of having absolutely no integrity in and of itself. There was no evidence of any type of voter fraud. Here he is on Fox News being interviewed by Bill Hemmer, who I think we still need to have on some type of watch alert because something's going on with Bill Hemmer. But
a bit loopy.
Do you have a therapy ad soon?
It's
transition.
Very close. But here's Chris Kobach. I want you to watch, because this is always interesting, to watch someone who you know is lying, who knows they're lying, and just to watch and see how they do it. Here is Chris Kobach.
So there was a fallout from the voter fraud investigation that you were a big part of. Has that
Pause
been
it
a
for one second. You know, to say that he was a big part of was an understatement. It was literally his entire initiative.
Architect of it.
Architect. He was like the design build firm and also the marketing firm and also financing for the project.
And maybe like chief imaginer. Like
exactly.
Some type of like Disney type
Imagineer,
of name.
I think is the word you're looking
right,
for.
Right, because it's a figment of his racist imagination.
Here is, this was, of course, the Voter Integrity Commission that was formed ostensibly because of the 3 to 4 million votes that were voted that were illegal from so-called legal immigrants.
From fallout from the voter fraud investigation that you were a big part of. Has that been a drag on you, sir?
Oh, not at all. No, Kansans know that I came in as Secretary of State promising to bring proof of citizenship and photo ID to Kansas elections. And we have proven many cases of people who are not U.S. citizens who registered and voted in Kansas elections. And that's true not just in Kansas. That's true all across this country. The fallout, so to speak, is the people on the left who say, well, sure, Kobach, you proved a few cases or a few hundred or in some instances a few thousand cases of people voting fraudulently. But that's not enough. Of course, it's never enough for the left. You can show them a million cases and they'll still say that's not enough cases of voter fraud to worry about it.
Two more questions. Do you think you could win today without the president's support?
There you go. Well, hard-hitting stuff, Hemmer. Way to follow up on that. The many cases to which Kobach referred to included less than 40 over the course of 20 years in one county in Kansas with 130,000 voters. For those of you who don't have a calculator on your phone for some reason, we're talking about 0.0003%. There's either three or four O's over the course of 20 years.
The point is, it's a big deal.
And I guess we were never going to have the opportunity to test the premise of whether or not the left would have an issue with millions of fraudulent votes. It's a lie. It's always been a lie. And there you had a perfect opportunity to see what a liar looks like when he's telling a lie on national television.
Yeah, I never seen that one before.
Well, so, you know, this one is like rock solid. But yes, I think that's true. We do see it very often.
He's like a 48-carat liar.
Indeed. Hey, support for today's show comes from Brooklinen. Named the winner of the best online betting category by Good Housekeeping, Brooklinen is the fastest-growing betting brand in the world with over 20,000 five-star reviews. In fact, both our advertisers today, well, I'll get to this in a moment, but their mission, bring five-star hotel-quality sheets to everyday life, offering luxury sheets without the luxury markup. The way they do it, they eliminate the middlemen. From design to manufacturing to customer service and beyond, they go direct to you. People have heard me talk about the multiple sets of Brooklinen sheets I have that have made, always tough to change your marital status. But having the comfortable sheets definitely helps. And sheets that you like, as opposed to maybe the person that you were involved with, you know.
Wow.
We had different types of I like the cool, crisp cotton sheets.
Who doesn't?
I know someone specifically who likes like the more, the other, a different type of sheet. Mm. So I got mine. And I'm going to say this twice today. I got my mom. My mom is moving into a new, she sold her house, moving into a smaller place. She got Brooklinen sheets.
Oh, you got your mom some sheets.
Yeah.
Very nice.
Now, my Brooklinen sheets are the best. My mom's are too. I'm not saying I just get the really good ones for me.
Let's get the second ones for mom.
Brooklinen.com is giving an exclusive offer just for my listeners. Get $20 off and free shipping when you use the promo code MAJORITY at Brooklinen.com. Brooklinen is so sure you're going to love their new sheets. They offer a risk-free 60-night satisfaction guarantee and a lifetime warranty on all their sheets and comforters. The only way to get $20 off and free shipping, use the promo code MAJORITY at Brooklinen.com. That's Brooklinen, Brooklinen.com, promo code MAJORITY. Brooklinen, these really are the best sheets ever. And also, as you know, folks, since we're talking about betting, I am the proud owner of two different Casper mattresses. Casper is a sleep brand that continues to revolutionize its line of products to create an exceptionally comfortable sleep experience one night at a time. I'm not sure how you could do it multiple nights at a time. But three mattress models, the original Casper. I have two of those, ladies and gentlemen. The Wave and the Essential. Casper mattresses are perfectly designed to soothe and cradle your natural geometry. It's breathable, so you sleep cool, regulates your body temperature throughout the night, and it is delivered right to your door in a small sort of how do they do that type of package. Free shipping and returns in U.S., Canada, and the thing that, in my mind, made Casper, it's what first sold me on Casper. It was the idea that you can sleep on it for 100 nights risk-free. That's over 3 months. And if you don't like it after the 99th night, you send it home, you send it back to them free. After all, you spend one-third of your time sleeping. You should be comfortable.
Have you been increasing your sleeping ratio?
Definitely.
Nice.
I mean, particularly when I'm not in the not with the kids.
That makes.
I mean,
that's.
But
that's
I also
the audience can follow a lot of progressions there, buddy.
Ordered a Casper mattress for my mom.
Aw.
Yep. There you go. I didn't pay for it.
Oh.
No, I said
Jewish son points.
Well, you got the hookup.
I mean, she sold her house. She's getting a new place. It's not like
Is Vinny Lucchese.
So your involvement was sending her the coupon code.
Got super sending the coupon code. I ordered it for her, and
they didn't give you a free one though.
No, I didn't get a free one. For
I was
my
gonna
mom.
Say
I would send a free one to my mom, but no, she's looking for a mattress, and I'm like. I'm super happy with my Casper mattresses. My point being that the mattress, I believe in the mattress enough to suggest it to my mom. That's the point. Not that I went out and I bought the mattress. All right? She's doing fine.
Knocked off a truck.
I've had to have this argument with my mom about it. Like, look, let's not get into this. You can get $50 towards select mattresses by visiting casper.com/majority. Using majority at checkout. So that's casper.com/majority. Use the offer code majority for $50 off your mattress purchase. Terms and conditions apply, ladies and gentlemen. All right, let's go through just a little bit more of the election results before we head to talk to Professor Western. And just a reminder, you can support this program by going to jointhemajorityreport.com, jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you get the show commercial-free, and you also get bonus material every day. And so jointhemajorityreport.com. So Ohio, incredibly narrow margin. What is it, 1% maybe? I don't know what the final tally is. They're going to be tallying up provisional ballots I don't know if they've got all the absentee ballots in. One would expect the provisional ballots to break Democratic, but probably not enough to overcome the deficit. There was a Green Party candidate who got less than the spread, as far as I know. I guess it's conceivable that the spread comes down, 100 or 200 votes, and then the Green Party candidate would have had enough to cover. I'm not one of those people who necessarily thinks that, particularly in a race that small, in a special election, with people who are that adamant about voting for the Green Party, that they would ever vote for anything else any more than I would, blame QAnon followers for not voting for a Democratic congressman in that district. Both are irrational, and I don't know if they're both following conspiracy theories, but both are irrational groups of people.
Somewhat irrelevant, shall we say?
Right. I mean, like I say, we talk about QAnon people. Why wouldn't we talk about Green Party people?
Well, QAnon have a pipeline to power in the present administration, unlike Green Party people.
That's true. That's true.
Also,
that's
they're
true.
Robert Mueller, so I think the comparison's a little
ridiculous. That's true, too. Mueller's in on QAnon. But anyways, with that said, the real story is, of course, you're talking about almost a 12-point swing. This is a plus 11 district for Donald Trump. And the turnout numbers in the suburbs were significantly higher than in the rural counties. So you had the highest income, best educated elements of the electorate came out, showed the most interest in voting. Now, it's tough to special election, whatnot, but that does not bode well necessarily for a Donald Trump type of person or other Republicans. In Michigan, Abdul al-Sayed did, I think, probably better than people anticipated based upon polls from a while back, but he lost by 20 points to Gretchen Whitmer. Whitmer was a former Democratic leader in the state legislature and, definitely to the left of where your sort of like typical Democrat was 5 years ago. Wants expansion for Medicaid, $15 an hour. There's things to commend her, but, al-Sayed, far more electric and interesting candidate. But it was also another primary day where women just crushed it. 11 women are nominated for governorships this year. And in places like Georgia and Maine, female candidates nominated could be the first women ever to be elected to their governorship. So that is a fascinating development. Also, as we mentioned, right to work went down in Missouri. That's big, super big and encouraging.
Hell yeah.
You will not see that in Michigan because in Michigan they included right to work to their appropriations, so you cannot have a referendum for that. In St. Louis County, the St. Louis County prosecutor who handled the Mike Brown case in Ferguson 4 years ago was ousted. So Bob McCullough gone, Wesley Bell in. That's a big deal. That was, I believe, they were both Democrats. It was a Democratic primary. So that is, that's exciting. What else do we have? Like I said, Kris Kobach is, looks like he could very well win. That will be a scary proposition. And also, I should say also about that Ohio's 12th district. That person's only going to serve for basically 20 legislative days. And both these guys are running again in the midterm in November. There will be no other primary. So they're both running in that midterm, so that campaign continues. It'll be interesting to see what happens after that fact. All right, we should take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll be talking to Professor Bruce Western. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. On the phone, it is a pleasure to welcome to the program Professor of Sociology now at Columbia University, author of Homeward, Life in a Year After Prison, Professor Bruce Western. Welcome to the program, Bruce.
Thanks so much for having me, Sam.
So, all right. So tell us about the study. Just the broad strokes of the, or you can get into the narrow strokes of the study that the book was based on.
Yeah, I was talking to 122 people. We recruited them in state prison in Massachusetts about a week before they were released, and we interviewed them in prison. And then we talked to people again 2 weeks later. So now they're out in the community. They've been released from prison. And we followed them over a year. And we were talking to them a lot about their housing, their family relationships, their employment, their health. And we're trying to understand how people make the transition from incarceration back into communities.
And these 122 people, I mean, how did you decide which ones to interview, or was it just simply as they were coming up for release?
Yeah, it was basically that. The only criteria for eligibility for the study was that you were returning to a neighborhood in the Boston area. And although the study was spanned the greater Boston area, we're in the field for 3 years talking to people, and we're basically in five or six neighborhoods, mostly very disadvantaged communities of color.
Okay, and so when you started the Boston reentry study, what were you specifically looking to find in terms of how people adjusted or how people got into prison or both?
I guess I was focused on the issue of adjustment, and there had been a lot of research and I had done a bunch of research on how serving time in prison affects people after they're released. And in the work that I'd done earlier, I was really focused on employment, how people with prison records find work, and how their families are doing. And I was studying these big data sets drawn on national samples. And I wasn't convinced I was really understanding the texture of people's lives, what it's like to go through. You've been institutionalized for 3, 4, 5 years, and you have to find your place in your community again. I wasn't convinced that I really understood that process well, even though, you know, I'd been studying it quantitatively with these big social surveys for many years.
And to what extent, and maybe I'm getting ahead of myself here, but to what extent does inputs affect the outputs? In other words, how the prisoners were situated beforehand implicate how they are as they are released?
Yeah, it's a really good point, and it has a big effect, and I think we learned a lot in this respect in the research, and there were two things that were really striking for us. And one is that the people that we were interviewing had been exposed to a lot of trauma and a lot of violence in their lives. It often dated from very early in childhood. And this was related to their health as adults. And a lot of the people we were interviewing were not in very good health. High rates of depression, high rates of PTSD. In many cases, are in poor physical health. They suffered with chronic pain, persistent drug addiction over their lives. And these kinds of things, exposure to trauma in childhood, poor health in adulthood, this made the whole process of the reentry back into the community very challenging. And we saw a lot of very deep poverty, a lot of housing insecurity after people got out of prison.
Talk a little bit more about the nature of that trauma. I mean, you sat down with 122 folks, and the one of the statistics that I think jumps out at you and certainly at me was the number of those people who had witnessed a death of a person.
Yeah, this was shocking. And you know, going into the project, I was not really attuned to this issue. I was sort of coming at it as a criminal justice person, as a poverty researcher. But as we got to know people, and we got to know a lot of the people in the sample really well, they began to open up to us about their lives. And we were hearing a lot about the different kinds of violence that they'd been exposed to, and a lot of chaotic home life. And about halfway through our field period, we're sort of into our six-month interviews, and we're thinking, man, we got to ask about childhood, and we have to ask about exposure to trauma in childhood. So we developed a whole module in our survey that really tried to take a deep dive into this. And we asked people, you know, did you grow up with someone who struggled with addiction? Did you grow up with family violence in the home? Had you witnessed someone being killed? 40% of our sample said that witnessed someone being killed. And we could only really get to these questions after we'd gotten to know people for about a year and really developed some rapport and trust with them. And for me, this whole area raises ethical questions as much as it does policy questions and social science questions about the process of reentry, because I think we divide the world in criminal justice talk often into these two separate spheres. There are victims and there are offenders, and the job of the criminal justice system is to punish offenders, but the people we were talking to had often very long and serious histories of victimization. And this makes the whole ethical equation much more complicated for me. And I think it should open the door to sentiments like mercy and leniency and compassion.
Well, let's get to the policy implications of that in a moment. But let's turn to the idea of reentry. What are, and presumably the idea is, right, is that like prison theoretically, or the way that we are sold the idea of the carceral state is it seems to be a two-part. Right? One is to ostensibly to protect society from these folks who are put into prison. And the other is to rehabilitate. Right. And to or I guess to punish and then to hope to rehabilitate. I mean, what is like what are the premises in which you measure success for prison as a researcher?
Yeah. So I think the overwhelming attention has been focused on the problem of recidivism. Do people engage in crime again after they come out of prison? Do they get arrested? Do they return to incarceration? And so that, I think, is where a lot of the research is. In my thinking, that's not quite the right focus, because a lot of recidivism lies beyond the control of the individual who's been incarcerated. The biggest predictor of return to incarceration in our data was relapse to addiction, and people were either engaging in new crimes to support their drug habits, so they were selling drugs or committing robberies to support their addictions, or they were failing drug tests. They were on probation or parole and they were being drug tested, and they failed a drug test. You know, for people who study drug addiction, you know, relapse is part of the process by which people can ultimately and sustainably become sober again. And there's very little scope in the criminal justice system to allow people the process of their recovery and allow for the possibility possibility of relapse. And you know, you think about probation and parole, which are meant to assist people in the community get back on their feet after incarceration and continue the process of rehabilitation. Probation and parole in practice are really surveillance authorities. Probation and parole officers aren't given the resources or the training to really help people with what they need, which is help managing their health, their addictions, help finding housing, and help finding employment. And so I think what we should be focused on, rather than recidivism, is social integration. How do people find their place in their communities and families again after they've been separated through this forced institutionalization of incarceration? And if we can do that, if we can promote social integration, then I think people will tend to desist from crime and become functioning members of their communities.
So, I mean, to have the positive agenda of how do we reintegrate people into the community will impact the negative agenda of preventing people from going back into prison. But is there also, I mean, and again, maybe I'm jumping ahead of myself here before we talk a little bit more about the data that you found, but is it part of the problem that as a society, we don't really, it's unclear to me that we subscribe to that the problem of recidivism is not necessarily, or the problem for that matter, you know, to put in a more positive way, the problem of how do we reintegrate a former prisoner into society, are really not, it's really not the way that most, at least Americans, I think, perceive prison, right? That it's more of like, we got to keep people safe, or it should be about punishment. And that the problem that you're talking about is the failure of succeeding at reintegrating people into the community is simply because there's no political will to do so.
Yeah, I think all of that is true, and we need to develop a different culture, a different language, a more realistic language of the kinds of social conditions that people are struggling with on the ground. Because the perspective, the dominant perspective, which you just described, makes a whole variety of assumptions about what the reality on the ground looks like. Crime is a decision made by people who are making bad moral choices. Victims and offenders are two different groups of people, and guilty offenders prey on innocent victims. And the kinds of things we were finding when we talked to people and got to know them and talked to their families, victims and offenders are not two different groups of people. People who have committed serious violence, and we shouldn't minimize that, often have very serious histories of victimization themselves. They often grew up in our poorest neighborhoods, our most segregated neighborhoods. Their opportunities were extremely poor from a very early age. For me, this is a social world that is just shot through with ethical ambiguity, and we got to come to grips with that reality. And I think American culture and politics can be very judgmental and moralistic, and doesn't really grapple with the harshness of the conditions of American poverty, which are unusually challenging for really low-income people, and particularly in communities of color, I think.
Okay, so give us some basic statistics. As you followed those 122 people, how many give us some basic statistics about how many returned to a place to live, how many returned to a job, how many had I don't know what the measure of the quantitative measure of sort of community or support is, but tell us some of the key findings that so that we can assess going forward, how effective we are at or our society is at integrating and then ultimately providing some type of foundation for people not to return to prison.
Yeah, great question. So I think the first thing is the level of material hardship that people faced in their first year out of prison. And so the average income of people in their first year out that we were interviewing was about $6,000 a year. And poverty researchers called that a level of deep poverty, which is about half the federal poverty line for people living alone. Housing was very insecure. We observed virtually no independent housing in the entire sample in the full year after prison. And this meant that people were either doubling up with family or they were living in shelters or some kind of transitional housing after they came out, or they were street homeless. And so housing was a tremendous challenge. Unemployment was widespread over the year. The unemployment rate was about 50%. Where people could find work, it was mostly in minimum wage jobs. There was a tiny exception to this in the sample, which I thought was really interesting and important. There was a small group of older white men that we interviewed that had connections to union jobs in the construction industry. And they were able to make $40 and $50 an hour in their first year out. So this was skilled work, unionized work that put them well above poverty. And I think if we were going to imagine an alternative, what socially integrative employment would look like, I think it would look like this sort of well-paying skilled work that would elevate people significantly above poverty. But in broad strokes, you know, this was the social reality that the people we're interviewing were encountering: a lot of material hardship, a lot of poverty.
What was the difference between how they spent that first year out of prison and the last year before they went into prison? Do you have that data? In other words, $6,000 a year as I leave prison, was I making significantly more before I went in?
Yeah, I mean, it varied a lot. And so for some people in our sample, maybe 30 or 40%, their final year before prison was just a downward spiral into their addictions. And so a lot of people we interviewed were really in crisis before they went into prison. Their housing was really insecure, and whatever gainful employment they could find was supporting a spiraling addiction. A lot of people made decent money dealing drugs. They weren't struggling with addiction themselves, but they were, they were involved in illegal activity and living not well, but at the poverty line. That's kind of the best the best case scenario for the people that we're interviewing.
How many
a poverty level income?
What percentage of people out of that 122 were addicts as they entered into prison?
About 35%. About 35% reported to us that that had problems with drugs or alcohol in their lives, and they had been doing some sort of drug or alcohol treatment in the past, often in a correctional setting, in the community or in prison.
And do you have data on how those white men who had access to union work, how they fared in terms of, I mean, and I guess it's hard, I don't know if there's a community integration index that you use or something, but in terms of recidivism, which I would imagine is inversely correlated to your ability to integrate into the community, do we have a sense of what their recidivism rate was as compared to the rest of the sample?
Yeah, it was lower, and about a third of the sample returned to custody, were reincarcerated at some point in the year that we were talking to them. And these older men who got union jobs, their recidivism rates were much lower than the sample in general. And not only were they not being drawn back into the system, they were beginning to set up private households themselves. They were paying taxes as part of their union jobs. They were getting small retirement annuities. Their lives just looked very different, and they're able to look forward in ways that a lot of the people we're interviewing could not. And a lot of the people we're talking to were in survival mode, and they're just really trying to get through the next day, the next week.
So the three primary the three priorities, I guess, that in terms of what it takes for reentry and for, you know, achieving that integration into community is income, healthcare, and housing, I would imagine, right? You need
that's
service.
Exactly right.
And so in Massachusetts, and we should say that out of these 122, there are obviously idiosyncrasies because you're in, you know, because of where you're located, right? I mean, it may be that there may be more, Boston is a fairly, I know Boston and Boston area fairly well. The idea of those relationships, those for older white men, does not come as a surprise, at least, you know, on its face in terms of Boston. And what the, you know, unionism, I would imagine, is probably the density amongst white folks higher than perhaps minority folks. But there's also this element of Massachusetts has a relatively speaking, I don't want to say generous, but at least they offer more by way of healthcare. Tell us how those elements implicate how people did, because this is sort of the best case scenario. I mean, maybe there might be other states, but this is on the high end of services provided if this is the goal to reintegrate people.
It's a really good point. And so, you know, Massachusetts, of course, is the home of Romney Care. It was the original Medicaid expansion state, and everyone coming out of prison was eligible for MassHealth, which is the Medicaid program up there. And the prison authority, the Department of Correction, was working with University of Massachusetts on enrolling people in Medicaid before they were released. And so we had about 100% healthcare coverage in the sample. And Medicaid expansion has been an enormous boon to the project of prisoner reentry. We don't think of it that way, but it's had enormous positive effects. And so continuity of care is really important, and a lot of people were able to continue managing their chronic conditions immediately after incarceration as when they were on the inside. And people also were enrolling in food stamps at a high rate, and so about 80% of the sample were in food stamps at some point in the year. And in a lot of states, a criminal record would disqualify you from food stamps, but you keep your eligibility in Massachusetts. And that paid $200 a month, which doesn't sound like much, but when you're very close to zero, $200 a month makes a big difference. And it really helped stabilize people's incomes immediately after they got out. So I think the Medicaid thing is a success story, and I think other states should seek to emulate it. It's a national model for how post-incarceration healthcare should be organized, in my view. The safety net, the cash benefits of food stamps were huge. You know, there's a debate now about instituting work requirements on food stamps.
Right.
And I think it would be a disaster. I mean, there's so much work-limiting disability for this group of people. You know, the people that needed food stamps the most are often in the poorest health, and work requirements would completely pull the rug out from under them.
And I would imagine also it's that much tougher coming out of prison to get a job. I mean, so you're dealing with sort of like two different strikes against you in terms of your ability to get work.
Yeah, absolutely. Employment was incredibly challenging, and this was one of the areas in which there was a really large racial inequality in the data. So the African American men we were interviewing in particular really struggled with employment. They just didn't have the kinds of social networks, connections to jobs that we saw among the white men we were interviewing. So they were cold calling a lot. They were doing minimum wage work where they could get it in food service, in warehouse jobs, and so on. And so in this kind of environment, I think transitionally, cash support is really important. And you know, most of the people we were talking to who were on food stamps transitioned off it within 6 months. It wasn't the picture of long-term welfare dependency that we're often sold on.
Let me ask you this: if you were to compare 122 people, and obviously I'm asking you to speculate here, but based upon the research you did, if you were to compare 122 people from the Massachusetts set, compare it to a state that has not expanded Medicaid. How much of a differential do you think you would see in terms of recidivism? Or would there be other factors that you can't necessarily control from? Maybe there are, I don't know. I mean, but how much would you anticipate based upon what you studied in Boston? How much of a difference would you think you would see?
Yeah, I think the key difference would be really sort of in the area of human suffering, to be honest. In the non-Medicaid state, we would see more emergency room visits, more health crises. People would be relapsing to addiction more. They would be not receiving treatment for chronic conditions like hepatitis and diabetes and asthma, all of which were very prevalent in the sample. And so I think that, you know, that's the big difference that I would see. I mean, you know, people would just struggle enormously, and they'd wind up in emergency rooms, you know, in the end, costing the state very much more than their Medicaid coverage.
All right. So, I mean, lastly, I mean, if we know this, it really does seem that in many respects, we have a lot of the answers we need to fix this problem, at least to some degree. And they're in many respects, they seem to be similar answers to how you would prevent people from entering into prison in the first place.
Yeah, yeah. And it's very much a cycle. You know, people, a lot of the people we're interviewing, it was not their first time in prison. So as a policy conversation, I think we can't draw a bright line between prevention and recidivism. The system is very much a revolving door oftentimes, and it contributes in its own way to destabilizing people, and contributes in its own way to the problem of return to incarceration.
Professor Bruce Western, the book is Homeward, A Life in a Year After Prison. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Sam.
Bye-bye. All right, folks. Going to head into the fun half. And folks, check out the book for sort of the case studies of individuals. It's not cheery, I should say, but it is fascinating to see how, in many respects, this is it's just about political will, where we decide as a society that we're going to care about human suffering. So
it makes me so mad.
It really is sort of shocking because you can see, it's not alchemy. You don't need to be a magician to figure out how to do this stuff. It's just a question of political will, and recognizing people's humanity, broadly speaking. But interesting that, another, to the extent that Republican governors allowed for Medicaid expansion in their states and allow folks who have gone to, means tested and whatnot, one little hidden, value of Obamacare, as it were, but obviously not nearly enough. Folks, a reminder, jointhemajorityreport.com is the way that you become a member and support this type of programming day in, day out, as a way of saying thank you. We give you extra content every day that's a little bit more cheery, a little more fun. We mock people. Hopefully, we'll get a lot of calls from QAnon believers and folks who voted green in Ohio's 12th just to get a sense of, what the rationale is for both those phenomena. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. And last night was a Tuesday night. Therefore, we can surmise that the Michael Brooks show happened. Is that right, Michael?
It happened well. We talked about something that, just real quick, someone asked me if we could mention again. In California, they're making inmates help clear the forest fires.
Volunteer inmates, Michael.
Quote, yeah. They called them on Twitter volunteer inmates. It's pretty disgusting.
Which volunteer means they're not being paid.
Right.
That's the key bit of information.
And the California Institute of California Corrections tweeted that out. And over 50 minors are out doing that as well. So we talked about that. Derek Davidson was on. We talked about Iran, Venezuela, a bunch of other segments. This Sunday for patrons, we're doing a deep dive into the Jeremy Corbyn anti-Semitism story and contextualizing it in UK politics and revealing the lies and actually some structural truths. So, find it all on Patreon and iTunes and our new YouTube channel too.
And Jamie, the Antifada.
Yes, episode 17 is now out. Oh, what are you pointing at? Oh, there's a shot of us. What? Nope, never mind. Episode 17 is now out, featuring Virgil Texas and Matt Chrisman of Chapo Trap House. We talk about two films from the 70s and 80s, respectively, about the dissolution of the working class in America, Blue Collar, and a little racial hijinks comedy called Gung Ho.
We talked about Gung Ho. It came up.
When?
What interview was it that I raised Gung Ho? That is the Michael Keaton movie about the Japanese takeover in the 80s of a car factory. It came up.
Oh, yeah?
I cited it in some interview. I can't remember. I feel like the professor I cited it to was like, yeah, I guess.
Well, it is a great film and a great lens for looking at the process of the shift to neoliberalism that happened in the 70s and the 80s in the U.S.
Maybe it came up in that interview that we're sitting on that we're going to play during vacation.
I really hope he said, sure, I guess.
This movie
was something to that effect. I was like, oh, you mean like Gung Ho, where Michael Keaton played the, yeah.
Yeah, whatever.
Like, this movie is designed to make you hate the working class. Like, they're just a bunch of, like, fat, lazy, entitled oafs just, like, smoking cigars and eating KFC on the job.
That's what Sam says.
There was a couple of, like, movies, like, Nine to Five? No. What was the one where she was a secretary from New Jersey, and she actually sort of like, maybe it was Nine to Five. I don't think it was Nine to Five. It was where she didn't get the credit that she deserved for really setting up this business proposal. I feel like it was like someone, not Richard Gere in the movie, but gosh darn it.
But it was
supposedly some type of like feminist 80s movie, but it was really sort of like a backhanded way of just saying like you still, you know, occasionally a secretary will be able to have some measure of that. It was horrible. That happened a lot in the 80s.
Maybe we'll talk about that one
next week. Tough time for America.
Also, can I plug my Rolling Stone story that I just published? Because it really dovetails with a lot of what you were just talking about with our guest. I was working on this story for a pretty long time. It's about drug-induced homicide laws and prosecutions, which is a growing trend in American law enforcement, whereby if you share, supply, or sell drugs to somebody and that person ODs and dies, you can be charged with murder. And there's no evidence that this is stemming the tide of overdose deaths in America, but there is some evidence that it is actually keeping people from contacting first responders when somebody is overdosing. And a lot of these prosecutions are not even drug dealers. They're whoever was last with the person who died. So if like the story that I spotlighted in this article is a guy who did drugs with his girlfriend right after her 19th birthday, and she died, and he was charged with second-degree murder under Louisiana's drug-induced homicide statute, and now he's been sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole.
Nuts. Well, that's sets us up nicely to go into the fun half. Matt, do you want to...
Literary Hangover. We did The Maypole of Marymount by Nathaniel Hawthorne. Check it out. It's on YouTube, on Patreon, everywhere.
All right, folks, going to take a quick break, head into the fun half of the program, wherein we will try and be funner.
Sorry, guys.
646-257-3920 is the number. We'll be right back.
Competition would start kicking in.
Are
I'm defenseless against that kind of female insanity.
I feel I have to get the gushing out first.